training. I'm going to call up the presentation materials and officially turn things over to my session co-moderator and fellow presenter, Anne Carroll. So, Anne, whenever you're ready to begin, please feel free.
Thank you so much, Jean, both to you and your team to help us set up this webinar today and, of course, hosting us. So I'd like to add my welcome to everybody who's joining us today, both on October 13th or at some later time. We're pleased to be joined by Brownfields and other colleagues from across the U.S. and several other countries had registered. So thank you for joining us. And for those who are listening after the event, welcome. My name is Anne Carroll. I am with the EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, National Program Office in Washington, D.C., and I'll be moderating today's webinar and kicking off portions of our discussion. We are especially pleased to be joined by our guest presenter, Brenda Dix, who is a senior management consultant of ICF. She has extensive adaptation experience, and I encourage you to review her bio on our webinar page, because I can't possibly do justice to her experience in the time we have. So there are a number of different resources that have actually been added, as Jean mentioned to you, the related URLs. They are both specific to the project we're talking about today and the modeling activities, as well as some general brownfields climate adaptation and resilient revitalization materials. So I encourage you to take a look at those, both for your current and perhaps future projects. Before we kick off today's webinar, we'd like to learn a little bit more about you. And so we have a few questions for you. So specifically, how long have you been working in your current brownfields or site remediation position? And of course, if it isn't site remediation but related, that still applies. So tell us how long you have been in this field. Great, we're getting lots of responses here, and it looks like many of you have 10 or more years experience. And we have a number who are less than 1 year. So. That's very exciting that we have many of our new colleagues joining us today. We also have what do you want to learn from the session as another question. There's certainly the answers I have so far are general best management practices, the sea level rise implications of sea level rise on brownfield sites, more about this topic, adaptation strategies. Well, you're asking a lot of us in this hour, so we better get cooking. And I think we will leave this open a little bit for those of you who might have been impacts to intercoastal plains with very shallow water tables. All right, great. Well, thank you for your response, and we look forward to at least trying to tackle some of today. Moving forward, I'd like to introduce you to our topic today. So we know that there are, you know, changing environmental conditions and climate. We know that sea level rise is increasingly understood to be a threat to coastal areas. This slide shows you, and this is slide 5 for those who might be not joining us online. We recognize the sea level rise will lead to more frequent flooding. We don't always recognize that it leads to more expansive flooding, but perhaps a dot that doesn't always get connected is when there is flooding, there is a potential for contaminant mobilization. And so that's another dimension of what we want to talk about today. And of course, when there is mobilization, that means there's potential for more exposures. And that's certainly related to some potential impacts that can be experienced by neighbors to brownfields, and of course, research has shown that this is often low income and in communities of color that are, you know, residing near brownfield sites. So it remains an environmental justice issue now and probably going into the future. So sea level rise causes and is associated with more frequent flooding, more expansive or wider flood events, and also increased shoreline erosion. So that will then increase future vulnerability. In addition, those might be related to elevated groundwater levels. So then you're not only worrying about a surface impact on the site, but in a subsurface impact as well. And the risks related to that sea level rise to brownfield sites and other contaminated sites, as well as those unrecognized contaminated sites, includes the mobilization of contaminants and debris, impeding or impacting adversely the stormwater drainage systems, as well as the damage to critical infrastructure and buildings. And in the case of sea level rise, we're not only talking about water damage, but saltwater damage, which might mean additional impacts both on infrastructure and buildings. And let's not forget, even as we're focusing on sea level rise as part of today's webinar, there's also the increase of inland flooding. So the changes in precipitation patterns are increasing the risk of inland flooding. Those might exacerbate the sea level rise impacts that we are likely to experience. There has been FEMA flood insurance rate maps have been sort of where everybody goes to find information both about the risk and also the financial risks associated with flooding areas. But there have been recent reports by the General Accountability Office and other government watchdogs that some of the FEMA flood maps are not being updated, so you might need to seek additional timely information about flood risks. Flood Factor is one screening tool that is trying to look at both sea level rise and future changes in the environment and how that impacts flood risk, but there are likely to be other tools that Brenda will tell us about too. So in the brownfields world, we often focus on that specific site that's the target of assessment or cleanup activities or those multi-site areas. And so really in this webinar, we want to remind folks, even as we're doing that site-specific activity or that multi-site activity, we need to think about those infrastructure connections because it would be great to be making those sites resilient, but we also want to make sure that the infrastructure connecting to and around those sites are also resilient. And so that's where sustainable redevelopment, an area of intense interest for the brownfields and land revitalization programs for a number of years, makes us think, you know, thoughtfully about how our site and that future site reuse is going to consider those connections and build resilience into the site as well as those local infrastructures and bring the communities along. So that's where keeping them engaged and involved as you are assessing the risks is critical to your projects and to their future participation in your reuse decision making. There are no downsides to considering sea level rise early in a brownfield redevelopment process. So you will increase the awareness of the consequences of sea level rise. You will better equip the community to be a partner in your project. You will reduce the costs, and you are providing yourself with more options and more management strategies the earlier you collect the information that you need. And so that really gives you a broader response option. It also gives you an opportunity to strengthen resilience in multiple ways, not only the site-specific resilience, but having the community as part of those conversations means there's opportunities for a broader community resilience discussion. So as noted earlier, there are resources at the end of this presentation. We also encourage you to go to the EPA Brownfields webpage and land revitalization webpages where you can get some additional tools that might help you with your resilience adventures. We have some listed here, the EPA Climate Smart Brownfield Manual, as well as Adapting to Rising Tides for Contaminated Land, and other materials that are also on the Brownfields webpage, the brownfield revitalization in climate-vulnerable areas, and the checklist to consider climate in brownfield cleanup activities. So with that, I'd like to turn the mic and the slides over to Brenda Dix. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Anna. That was a fantastic introduction. I really appreciate you setting the stage like that. So I'm going to be walking you through some sea level rise science and screening tools. And hopefully you'll be able to input your questions if you have any if they come up in the Q&A box. So first, I have a question for you, though. We would like to understand a little bit better about what level of experience you have with assessing sea level rise. Anything from none, which you're in the right place if that's the case. You've read some about sea level rise projections, have used the sea level rise viewer to explore local impacts, have conducted a site-specific assessment, or have developed sea level rise adaptation strategies. So I'll give it a minute for some results to come in. It's looking like a lot of you are early in your journey, have maybe read some about sea level rise projections or have no experience with the topic. So hopefully this training today will be very educational and help get you started in the right direction. So first, a little bit about the sea level rise process. Just why is sea levels rising, and how do we understand it? There is first global sea level rise, and that's caused by a series of events. First, increased global greenhouse gas emissions from human burning of fossil fuels and other factors, which increase the greenhouse effect on around the Earth, really, and leads to warmer atmospheric temperatures. Those warmer temperatures end up melting the ice at our polar ice caps. So that water runs off into the ocean, creating higher sea levels. Plus, the water in the oceans is warming up. And as water warms, it expands. So that also increases the elevation of our sea levels. But sea level rise isn't experienced the same way across the world. It's not just a universal rise. There are regional factors that need to be considered to understand exactly how sea level rise has impacted in the past and will continue to impact the regions in which all of you live. And that's due to things like subsidence and uplift. So mountains that are continuing to rise, or areas in the Gulf Coast that have been pumping water out of their aquifers and the land is actually sinking. That obviously makes the relative sea level rise higher. So a little bit about past sea level rise trends. As you see on the left, sea level rise is not a new phenomenon. This is something that has been going on since the 1880s, or at least that we've been measuring and tracking since the 1880s. And you can see cumulative sea level change of about 9 or so inches between that period and current day. And then on the right, you can see exactly what I was talking about with relative sea level change, that it's not experienced the same everywhere around the world. So you can see on the East Coast, for example, of the U.S., more of those yellow and orange colors, which indicate higher rates of sea level rise per decade, as compared to off the coast of Mexico, for example, the West Coast of Mexico, where there's been limited to no sea level rise. And that's due to those factors like subsidence and uplift, as well as things like currents and other ocean dynamics. And how do we think this is going to play out in the future? So as you can see in this particular map, in 2100, or between now and 2100, we expect differential sea level rise around the U.S. You'll see a lot of red in the Gulf Coast area, which means we are looking at about 5 to 6 feet of sea level rise projected by the best available science in that region. The East Coast, also in that 4 to 5 feet in orange, versus most of the west coast of the U.S. and Florida in the 3 to 4 feet range. And Alaska, actually, you see very little to no sea level rise because Alaska is continuing to raise their elevation and have uplift at a rate that's faster than sea levels are rising. And so that's one of the reasons why we really encourage you to go through the type of screening process that I'm going to talk through today, because things aren't the same everywhere. It's very site and location specific, and we'll give you the tools and resources you need to understand that. So I'm going to walk you through a Sea Level Rise exposure screening process. And what I want to emphasize is that it is easy. You can do this. There's no need to be concerned. You're in a very fortunate position where many federal agencies have come together, as well as academics and other institutions, to put together a suite of tools that you can use, at least at a screening level, to understand site-specific risks. So the four steps that I'll walk through are exploring sea level rise projections, visualizing potential flooding, determining impacts, and developing adaptation strategies. In the first presentation, I'll focus more on steps one and two, and then in the case study, after we take some Q&A, that case study will help to highlight steps three and four in more detail. So step one, exploring sea level rise, abbreviated here as SLR, projections. The first recommended step, in my opinion, is to visit the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Sea Level Change Curve Calculator. You see the link there at the bottom of the slide. It's also in the resources materials that Jean mentioned and Anne mentioned at the beginning of the presentation on the CLUIN website. And throughout this series of slides, I'm going to be focusing in on the portions of the slide that are highlighted in an orange box. That's really where I want to draw your attention. So to use this tool, you really only need to input two things. The first is selecting a tide gauge, and you likely don't know which tide gauge is closest to your site from the drop-down menu, and that's why they provide a map on the right. You can zoom in to where your site is located, find the closest blue pin, click on it, and it'll tell you the name of that tide gauge, and then you can pick it from the drop-down for select gauge. Then we need you to pick the scenario source. There's a few in here, but the recommended one is NOAA et al. 2017. This is the best available science at the full national scale. As you can tell from the name, it's produced by NOAA, and it is the current state of the science. So once you select those two elements and scroll down on that same page, you'll see a chart that looks very similar to this one. This is an example for Washington, D.C., and it shows you the range of sea level change projections for your site. So on the y-axis is relative sea level change in feet, and on the x-axis is the year. And you'll see there are a bunch of different curves here, and so I'll talk through which ones you should be picking and using. But the main sort of point to start with is that sea level rise projections are more constrained, closer to where we currently are in time. So we know much more about what's going to happen in the next 20 years or so than we do all the way out to 2100. And that's in part because we are uncertain about how the globe, we will change our reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. So how policies by nations around the world are going to affect greenhouse gas emissions and thus sea level rise. So the first step we want you to decide is what year you should be focusing in on. And we really recommend defining the year based on the project or the site's time horizon, its planning horizon. And that varies by the type of infrastructure that you're considering. So for example, a roadway generally is built for about a 30-year useful life. After that time, we anticipate it will need to be reconstructed. So if you're interested in a roadway, which we'll be looking at in our case study, you might be focused in on those 2050 sea level rise projections. Alternatively, if you are constructing a building, buildings usually are around longer, on average, about 60 years, so you might want to be looking out to the 2080 sea level rise projection. And for really serious pieces of infrastructure like a bridge, a major bridge, we design those to last as long as we possibly can. They are very large investments, so looking out to that 2100 timeframe is likely most appropriate. So even once you've selected your year of interest, you still need to pick which one of those curves to look at, which one of the points basically along this dot is going to be of interest to you. And our recommendation is that you don't necessarily look to the most extreme scenarios. So we don't recommend the extreme or the high for the vast majority of purposes. Those are really the absolute worst case, highly unlikely scenarios. It's good to be aware of them, but for most of your planning, it's not what you want to be planning to. And likewise, the other end of the spectrum, the VLM, which stands for vertical land movement, and the which does not actually incorporate sea level rise, and the low scenario, those are really below what science is currently saying will occur in the future, as well as below what we've been observing in the recent past. So we would recommend focusing in on the middle three curves, which are the intermediate low, intermediate, and intermediate high. And those scenarios could help bracket your analysis. So for planning, it doesn't hurt to take a look at all three. If you want to narrow in on just one scenario, there's a couple of different ways to pick that. You could consider the project's risk tolerance. So going back to my examples on the last day of the last page, a road, for example, is something that obviously is important for transportation, but if it's a minor side street, you know, maybe occasional flooding would be okay in that situation, so maybe your risk tolerance is a little bit higher. You could consider the intermediate low scenario. For a more major roadway, you might want to be looking at that intermediate, as well as for buildings, maybe that intermediate scenario, really middle of the road. For that bridge example that you really want to make sure lasts, there's usually limited redundancy in bridges. It's the only option to cross a waterway. That's the type of situation where you'd want to be looking at that intermediate high. And when in doubt, just look at the intermediate. That could certainly make your life easier as a starting point. So an example that we'll be carrying forward through some of the next stages is a building. So that 2080 timeframe is appropriate for how long we anticipate the building will be in place for. And I've narrowed in here to those middle three scenarios, which means that we should be considering sea level rise of between 2 to 5 feet, as you can see outlined in the orange box on this slide. So once you understand what is the sea level rise science saying for your site location and project, and you've narrowed in on the year and scenarios you want to look at, you can use NOAA's Sea Level Rise Viewer as a tool to visualize what that means at a particular site. And again, the link is at the bottom of this slide, as well as available on the CLUIN website. There are other sea level rise viewers out there. Many of them are very good. We're recommending NOAA because it is a nationwide data set, and it has some of those types of advantages. However, there's a link down here that gives you a nice matrix summary of pros and cons of other sea level rise viewers by state. So you can check that out. It's possible in some locations, such as California, that more detailed modeling has been produced and it might be the best in class in your location. However, NOAA is a great place to start. So on NOAA's Sea Level Rise Viewer, if you see this orange box here, there's a slider bar. It's very simple. You can slide it up and down after zooming into your site to understand the extent as well as depth of flooding in various locations. So taking our example from before, where we wanted to consider a building with 3 to 5 feet of sea level rise, in the top version of the graphic, you see 3 feet of sea level rise and what that looks like in this particular location. In the bottom graphic, you can see we've changed the toggle on the side, the slider, to 5 feet of sea level rise. And so these represent future daily tide conditions, so that mean high or high water, also known as the highest high tide of the day. This is the type of flooding you would expect to see. So these are not storm scenarios. It's just daily flooding, permanently inundated, essentially. And you can see between the top graphic and the bottom graphic, that extent of flooding is changing and expanding, as Anne mentioned would occur, as well as the blues become deeper in color gradient, which also indicates that the actual anticipated depth of water is deeper. So while that shows you daily flooding, it can be beneficial to understand potential future storm surges. Usually we design infrastructure to be able to handle a certain level of storm, whether that's a 10-year storm, a 25-year storm, a 100-year storm, it depends. But it's good to at least take a look at those types of scenarios. So to understand extreme water levels in your location, I recommend going to this NOAA's Extreme Water Levels link. And again, it's a very easy graphic interface. Zoom into your area of concern, pick the closest one of these various arrows that you see around the map, and it gives you a very simple pop-up. So in this particular example of Miami Beach, it says the 1% annual exceedance probability levels are 1.07 meters or 3.51 feet. That's the part you want to focus in on. So that's saying today's 100-year flood scenario, 100-year coastal storm event, which is that 1% annual chance of exceedance event, could result in water levels that are 3.5 feet higher than usual. And so applying that to our example from earlier, you want to do some simple arithmetic here. When we were looking at 3 to 5 feet of sea level rise by 2080, let's use that high end, the 5 feet as our starting point. Let's add the 3.5 feet to it for the 100-year storm surge. And we get a rough estimate that the future 2080 100-year storm surge will result in water levels that are 8.5 feet above today's high tide level. And if we flip back to our NOAA Sea Level Rise viewer, change that slider bar on up. In this case, I rounded up to 9 feet. This is only in 1 foot increments. You see a lot more flooding. And it's good to understand the difference between temporary flooding, which has very different impacts, but it still certainly could be enough to mobilize contaminants, as discussed, to cause damage, but it would not cause permanent inundation. So that's the summary of how you understand what sea level rise could just look like at your project site in the future. Step three is to determine potential sea level rise impacts. And for this, we just recommend running through a simple series of questions to help explore this topic a little bit. So starting from the beginning, things like asking yourself, what is the planned reuse? Then based on the information that you've just gathered, will the site experience daily flooding or flooding during a storm event? And once you have those pieces of information, let's think about these impacts. So how might that inundation or other factors that are impacted by sea level rise that Anne explained, like groundwater table rise and erosion, affect the use of the site? Then there are contributing factors that you might want to be considering as well, such as does the site have impervious surfaces that would exacerbate flooding? So if that water gets trapped and isn't able to be absorbed or drain off, will nearby assets and the site's use be impacted? Again, these connections to the community, to facilities and infrastructure that are necessary for the effective operation of the site, like the main roadway connecting the site to the rest of the community, or could there potentially be impacts to the energy system, which would impact or disrupt energy services, or things like telecommunications or other key essential services nearby? And then how will nearby communities and the environment be affected? This is obviously something we always want to be asking ourselves as well, to not forget that the brownfield is a part of that broader community and that we need to create, as Anne was saying, resilient and sustainable sites. So I'm going to run you through some potential adaptation strategies. This is the part everybody likes getting to. How do we solve the problem, or at least start to chip away at it? And there are many different types of options available to you. Some are physical strategies, so I'll run through those first. That is the physical barriers to protect your site and yourself from sea level rise. So So the top example that you see here is a hardened shoreline. It can mean a seawall, it can mean a levee, anything of that nature that is an engineered flood protection feature designed to keep water at bay. On the bottom, you see nature-based solutions. These have proven very effective, especially in storm surge situations. So if your site was not necessarily impacted by daily flooding, but is going to be impacted by those storm surge events, a nature-based solution could be really effective at knocking down the waves and thus reducing how far inland the extent of flooding goes and how high the storm surge is. Plus, they obviously have many co-benefits, such as providing habitat, increasing the ecological features, as well as for tourism and fishing, and they're just nicer to look at. So we certainly recommend those solutions. Additional physical strategies that you may consider is site relocation. And obviously, we don't mean the entire site, but if there's something that you're planning to construct on the site or additional infrastructure that you're planning to connect to the site, could it be shifted within the footprint to an area of higher elevation, for example? Or the last physical strategy on here is, can you consider options like a floodable park? So these are non-permanent structures.
Enter your conference
clearly.
Followed by the pound or sign.
I'm hearing some other noise.
I'm sorry. Bear with me, Brenda. I'm going to come on the line here and correct this. I apologize for that brief disruption. So I'm going to go ahead and mute the caller. Okay. And so bear with me. Brenda, I may have muted you. I'm going to mute one other line here. And again, I'll just remind all of my participants, if you could please remain muted on your line, that would really help us. Brenda, you should have that phone command if you need to unmute the one we used earlier. So feel free to press that. You should be able to say hello.
Okay.
I can still hear you, so go right ahead, Brenda.
Excellent. Thank you. So back to floodable parks. It doesn't necessarily have to be a park. However, it is nice to provide public amenities such as parks. And the idea here is that you are buying space, essentially. So this, again, is a situation where you would want to design the park more than likely to be above the future everyday sea level rise level, which might require some increase in site elevation. However, for that storm surge concerns, a floodable park can be a really great way to, again, absorb water, to stop it from reaching further inland areas that might have more expensive infrastructure that's more likely to be damaged. And so this park, if it is flooded during a storm surge event, would be relatively easy and inexpensive to clean up. We also want to recognize planning strategies that are available to you. These are not physical strategies, but are also very important considerations. It's not always the hammer that we need of a physical solution to help with thinking about sea level rise and taking the right steps. So some of the planning strategies available are prioritizing site assessment and cleanup to mitigate sea level rise consequences. So if you are seeing from that mapping exercise that there is potentially significant portions of your site that could be flooded, maybe that's a sign that you want to prioritize the assessment or you want to monitor for mobilization of contaminants. So recognizing that sea level rise doesn't happen all at once. It's not that one day you're high and dry, and the next day you're permanently underwater, you see slowly increasing frequency of flooding over time up to that point of permanent inundation. So that could buy you the time you need to monitor for mobilization of contaminants and take action when needed. So I also somewhat discussed the last one on, or the next one on the last slide, about considering resilient uses for the site, but it is good to think about that in the planning process. Proactively plan and budget for increasingly frequent floods. This is another good option where you might want to be putting aside budget for cleanup activities, whether that is removing debris from sites, has to do with contaminant cleanup, or even things like cleaning out your drainage structures and systems to make sure that water is able to flow freely and be drained from the site. You also want to conduct public outreach about potential impacts. If you do this type of screening and you recognize that there is a large potential impact in the location, it's not necessarily something we recommend keeping to yourself. So as you're considering reuse options, as you're considering planning for site development, we'd recommend making the public aware of these concerns and issues and collaboratively thinking about solutions. And along those lines, we also recommend coordinating with surrounding sites. It can be an ineffective solution, or at least an ineffective use of resources, if you just, for example, elevate a single building to protect it from sea level rise. It might be a better strategy to pair up with your neighbors and build one of those seawalls like you saw on the earlier slide. So that's more of a continuous strategy that will be more effective at a larger sort of neighborhood or community level scale. We also recommend soliciting knowledge on historical flood impacts, and this is something you can do now. It sends a strong message to people when they hear stories about historical impacts and what that meant and how that affected the site and the community. I think that can go a long way towards understanding what the future might look like more and more frequently, and go a long way towards helping move the discussion forward about adaptation strategies and the importance of investing in adaptation. So a little bit on when you might want to do this type of analysis. What I really want to emphasize is that you should consider sea level rise risk before you're making key decisions about the site. So for example, if you can do this type of screening before site assessment prioritization, it could be a really useful input into that prioritization. Obviously not the only factor. I definitely don't want to imply that. However, it could be a factor in prioritization. It could also be a factor in determining cleanup level. So if there's greater risk of potential contaminants, movement during sea level rise and storm surge events, then that's something that we want to keep in mind. And also considering sea level rise risk before reuse visioning and planning and site design. That gets back to these ideas of thinking about what are appropriate uses for a site that may be temporarily or even permanently inundated in the future, like some of those floodable parks and things of that nature. And lastly, in this section, we want to encourage stakeholder engagement throughout this process. As I mentioned before, you should be able to engage the public to achieve equitable resilience for local communities, and thinking more holistically about the strategies that would not just protect your site, but also help to protect those communities collaboratively. I want to encourage you to connect with local and regional planning agencies to ensure compatibility of plans. So if your local and regional planning agencies are going full force and also developing adaptation plans, it'd be good to be aligned with that. Alternatively, if they're considering strategic retreat in certain locations, that could also obviously have an impact on the potential use of the site. We also recommend coordinating with infrastructure owners who service the site and may also experience sea level rise impacts. From my professional experience, transportation agencies tend to be fairly far along in considering this topic, so they might even have studies and analyses of the area that they could provide to you and give you that head start you need. Energy utilities generally are starting to think about this topic, and there are many others that might be able to help you along the way and coordinate with. So with that, hopefully a useful overview of these great tools that are available to you and easy to use to get started on understanding this topic, I'll open it up for some Q&A.
Thank you. We've had a very active chat room. So let me back us up. So there was a question about what is a reasonable time frame for a contaminant cap, for example. That there is, you know, a lot of work in this location that uses a 30-year horizon for a cap and for paying for a cap. And so wondered whether a 30-year horizon or perhaps some other time frame would be better. And other ideas are welcome.
Great. Thanks, Anne. So in general, we do recommend aligning your sea level rise horizons with your other planning horizons. So if you're considering 30 years for other purposes, 30 years would be appropriate to consider for sea level rise as well. However, it's always beneficial to look at those further out scenarios just to be aware of them and take a quick glance in order to help set that risk tolerance. So what is your particular risk tolerance for this site and that cap, and how far out do you want to be planned? Any other questions, Ann?
Yes. I thought Kevin might jump in, but he's not. So do the models predict a consistent, steady increase in sea level rise or via steps or jumps?
So they do not project steps and jumps is not how I would explain it. However, I also wouldn't necessarily call it a steady rise. They, as you saw in some of those curves, it's an accelerating curve over time. So there is a faster rate of increase further out in the century compared to closer to where we currently are in the current day and age. So it's good to take a look at each of those curves to see how that might change.
And in case you're not tired of my dulcet tones, there was a question about when would be the occasion that you would use the high level?
It's a good question. Generally, for planning purposes, I don't think it would be necessary to use the high. I think the intermediate high is a very reasonable high scenario. However, if you are located in California, for example, and are close to the coast, California is by far the most aggressive state that I have seen in terms of considering that high scenario. And they, through their Coastal Commission, do recommend use of that scenario in select occasions where there's a very low risk tolerance for potential flooding. So I would say checking your local regulations is a good way, but California is the only state that I know of that's currently encouraging use of that scenario.
Great, thanks for that. There was a question about whether you're familiar with the wetness index.
I am not familiar with that one, but now I am very curious. So,
well, I think that means that we'll have to follow up with that person and have some information that we post on our website after the fact.
Perfect.
There's another question here about the lack of a regulatory body for enforcement for construction or placement of infrastructure within the floodplain. And other than the local government, is there a regulatory body for consultation? The Army Corps of Engineers does not regulate when the floodplain is not WOUS. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Right. So what I would say is that this is a quickly evolving landscape, and it is generally true that there are not regulations related to the elevation for placing infrastructure in potential floodplains. There are requirements in most locations based on FEMA's floodplain maps that infrastructure be designed to the 100-year floodplain level plus some freeboard. So that's for things like buildings or critical infrastructure. In other locations, we're starting to see local municipalities or states adopt specific sea level rise standards that go above and beyond those requirements. So that's things like in Virginia, for example. They have passed state-level guidance that states that for state buildings as the starting point, I imagine this will be expanded in the future, they need to add 2 feet of sea level rise to their ground floor elevations for all state-owned buildings. I'm trying to think of some other examples. Here in my home location of New York City, there's also requirements for all municipal-owned infrastructure to be considering sea level rise and to integrate it into the design. They have selected sea level rise scenarios for specific points in time that must be considered, and I know that they're considering that to be a pilot that then would be rolled out to all infrastructure construction in the city. So I know Florida has also adopted some policies on a city-by-city basis, So this is all to say that it's good to be aware of the local regulatory framework in which you're operating, because this is such a rapidly evolving space.
So I have possibly a short question and a longer question. One is, can you expand on the use of floodable parks? And do we have any examples? And I know I am familiar of at least some floodable park design in the Menominee Valley, but you might have another. And that was the short one. And then the other is, could you go over predicting the storm surge again? I did not understand the link between the NOAA Extreme Water Level tool and the Sea Level Rise tool.
Yes, certainly.
And thank you, you active audience, for your questions.
So I'm going to go back in the slides for a minute here. So floodable parks, and anyone that's interested in that topic, I did not mention that there is a link here on this slide, if I can get my pointer in the right place, to New York City Parks Design and Planning for Flood Resiliency. I think that's a really great resource to learn more about this topic. And they, in that resource, have examples of several different types of floodable parks that have been designed both in New York City as well as other locations, as sort of mini case studies. And they talk about things like what types of vegetation should you be putting in a park that might be flooded, how do you do appropriate terracing up through the park levels, and some of those other factors. So I think that's a very good resource. Then for storm surge, right, so I'll go through it slower, and I hope that this resolves the question. So when you're first using the NOAA Sea Level Rise Viewer, I recommend just using it for those baseline sea level rise scenarios that you are looking at on these curves. And so that might be, as in this example, 3 feet to 5 feet of daily flooding. But that's just what's flooded at high tide every day. And so it's not showing you the much further inland extent and depth of water that can come when there is a storm, like in my location, a nor'easter, or a tropical storm or hurricane even in our Gulf states, or any type of really storm surge situation that frequently could occur. And the best way, in my opinion, to get pretty simple information on the water levels that could be associated with that storm surge. So the additional increment of water that's going to rush inland during a storm event is to visit this NOAA's Extreme Water Levels website and click on the closest arrow to where you're located. And then you'll get this pop-up that says, the 1% annual exceedance probability levels are blank in your location. In this example, 3.5 feet. So the way that what we're trying to say is that in the future, that 3.5 feet is not going to be accurate, because that's 3.5 feet today. Once you have 3 feet of sea level rise, so your standard basic level, your sort of standing water elevation is 3 feet higher than it is today due to sea level rise, you need to take that storm surge increment and add it on top of the sea level rise increment. So you're going to want to add together your sea level rise estimate, in this case 3 to 5 feet, plus that 100-year storm surge increment, 3.5 feet in this case, to get a grand total of 8.5 feet of water that's going to rush inland during a future 100-year storm surge. So it's a combination of the standing water plus that additional increment from storm surge that you can go and plug back into NOAA to understand what the extent and depth of flooding might look like in that case.
Thank you so much. I think we want to wrap up the questions now, and we will plan to follow up with them and post answers to some of them on the website. And of course, if we have a little time at the end, we might be able to come back to them. So thank you, everybody, for your engagement. And let's move on.
Great. Thank you, Anne, for keeping us on track. So I next want to talk about a case study that we developed for Philadelphia Delaware Avenue Extension. Anne, did you want to speak for a moment about the background on this project?
So I think that I will be very brief, and I will let you know that there was a brownfield area-wide plan that was in the target area that looked at two catalyst sites. And then as part of that project, one of the questions was there going to be a road extension to those targeted sites for the reuse? And there was always a plan both to reuse them in some way that would also connect the community back to the waterfront. And so the further technical assistance project really helped the city look through that, but that also then required, because a road was being extended, for there to be a sea level rise assessment for the roads. And that's me, over to you.
Thanks, Anne. Yeah, so we were fortunate to get to work with the City of Philadelphia on this project, and Pennsylvania DOT, also known as PennDOT, was also a key player in the project, since they are the ones constructing the roadway that Anne just mentioned that runs through the two catalyst sites. And I want to be clear that the recommendations that you're going to see in this presentation came from ICF and our subconsultant SGA, and so they do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the city, PennDOT, or EPA. So here's a map of the project site. This is in Philadelphia along the Delaware River, as you can see on the lower right-hand corner of that map. The Delaware River is a tidally influenced river, so it does experience sea level rise. The two darker brown colored parcels are the catalyst sites that were included in the 2015 area-wide plan to explore reuse. And the roadway intended to serve the sites really runs, or is anticipated to run, along the river here and through the sites connecting up to the freeway. So under today's existing conditions, portions of the proposed roadway alignment and the catalyst sites at large are subject to flooding under the current 100-year storm and 500-year storm. So what you're looking at on this map is FEMA's flood insurance rate map, designated areas for, in darker blue, the 100-year storm surge area, and in lighter blue, the 500-year storm surge area. And again, outlined in yellow here are the two catalyst sites. So after we went through the process of selecting the most appropriate sea level rise scenario and out years that we wanted to look at based on the life of the roadway as well as a bridge that would be constructed, we took a look at the maps exactly like I instructed you to do earlier. And the findings were that in 2050, there would be more extensive and severe potential flooding during storm events. And by 2100, there's the potential for daily high tide flooding and chronic flooding. So walking through this table in a bit more detail, you see the today 2018 row, that's the baseline year for the data. The green means that there would not be any flooding along the roadway, the proposed alignment, during high tide flooding or mean high or high water, nor during chronic flooding. So chronic flooding is flooding that occurs approximately twice a month, so every other week. There would be, in yellow, limited sections of flooding, very limited, during the 10% annual chance storm that occurs approximately once every 10 years, and also limited flooding during the 4% annual chance storm, it's about a 25-year storm, and significant flooding during the 1% or 100-year storm. Walking forward in time to 2050, as you can see, we were considering 1.1 feet of sea level rise based on the same data sets that we were looking at earlier. And how would that affect the roadway? It would still be fine under the high tide scenario, so day-to-day traversing of the roadway would be fine. It would also not be impacted by chronic flooding, that biweekly flooding. However, you would see movement from very limited patches of flooding to pretty extensive flooding along the roadway during the 10% annual chance storm and the 4% annual chance storm. And then once you get out to 2100 with 3 feet of sea level rise, that's a more significant change, obviously. Even during daily high tide conditions, you would see limited patches of flooding along the roadway, essentially rendering it inoperable at that point in time. And you would see significant flooding on a biweekly basis. So what does that look like visually? In black, running through this graphic, or this map, you see the proposed roadway alignment, and outlined in, I think it's brown, you see the Philadelphia Koch National Grid site and the Rahmenhaus Dow Chemical site. So in this case, the lightest shade of purple, which you only see limited segments of, such as here, that's an area that would be flooded every day during high tide in 2050. The darker purple is areas that would be flooded every day in 2100. Moving that forward to the chronic inundation, this is the biweekly flooding. You see much more significant changes with that darker purple 2100 scenario really accelerating and covering a greater area. And last but not least, certainly, the future 100-year conditions. So everything that you're seeing in blue on this map is in today's floodplain, the maps that I showed you earlier with today's floodplain. The purple represents the expanded future floodplain for the 100-year flood event in 2050 for the light purple and 2100 for the dark purple. And so this is obviously where you see the most significant impacts. Really, basically, the river would be overtaking significant portions of this site. So I wanted to pause for a minute and talk about some of the other potential impacts of sea level rise at the site. It's important to not lose sight of these types of things, such as coastal erosion. So as you have those chronic flooding events, the daily high tide that's higher, you probably saw on the map that the proposed roadway alignment is relatively close to the river. And so those higher sea level rise levels are going to cause increased erosion that's going to eat away at that embankment if it's not armored in some way. So that's certainly a concern for the design. Another potential concern is groundwater elevation. So as sea levels rise, groundwater tables also rise near the coast. And if you already had a shallow groundwater table, it's going to have some pretty significant impacts potentially. First, reduced ability to capture and store freshwater flows during precipitation events, which is going to increase the potential for inland flooding during rainfall type of events. And this is compounded by the fact that, as Anne mentioned in the introduction, climate change will also be increasing the frequency and severity of rainfall events. So when we do get rainfall events, they're expected to be heavier, much heavier rainfall, in part because warmer atmosphere holds more water that can then dump during those events. It's also important to recognize the increase in the frequency and elevation of subgrade saturation. For the particular example of the roadway, this is important. I think it's also important to consider for the brownfield sites. For the roadway, the more frequently that the subgrade is flooded, even if the surface of the road isn't, that can soften the pavement and substructure and lead to damage of the road. Obviously, that increasing groundwater table, if it gets high enough, also increases the possibility of mobilizing hazardous materials at the brownfield site. So even if you don't see it on the surface, there could still be impacts from sea level rise. So what were the proposed solutions in this location? We broke it into two different types of strategies, some related to the roadway design, and some that are site or area-wide considerations. So for the roadway design, there are some options here that probably aren't too surprising. Obviously, elevating to account for sea level rise, especially that mid-century 2050 projection. After that, we would anticipate that the roadway would be replaced or rehabilitated, at which point maybe then you increase to that 2100 level. We also recommended designing for future loads associated with higher storm surge water levels. So as that water comes rushing in during a 100-year storm, it has a lot of force to it. Water is relatively heavy. So making sure that the roadway embankment can handle that force is important. We also recommended considering changes in design of drainage. So if the roadway is elevated, we want to make sure that it's not going to trap water on the landward side during a rainfall event, but there is sufficient ways and drainage for water to get out to the river for those overland flows, particularly, as I mentioned, since inland flooding events are also expected to increase intensity and severity. And we recommended designing for flexibility for additional protection. So this is somewhat what I was recently discussing, where the roadway can be designed for 2050 now to that elevation. It can also be designed with strong enough of a foundation that you don't need to fully scrape it all out and start over when you're reconstructing it to move towards 2100. It can be strong enough of a base that it's able to be elevated further in the future. It's also things like acquiring additional right-of-way so that you can expand into that right-of-way to have a larger embankment for that future elevation. Then we highlighted some site and area-wide considerations, one being protecting the coastal edges from increased erosion due to sea level rise. So making sure that that erosion is addressed at the coast. And that could be through some of those nature-based solutions that I discussed earlier, like marshes and wetlands. Another option could be elevating the adjacent riverfront parks. So the area-wide plan indicated that there is, in at least segments, anticipated to be a riverfront park between the roadway, which also contains a trail bike path, and the waterfront. So rather than elevating the road, could we turn that park into the type of floodable park or a levee even that has park features on it? That would help protect not just the roadway, but also the surrounding communities. We recommended coordinating flood protection with other infrastructure actors, as we discussed, and disclosing the future flood risk to ensure resilient development of the broader site. So as additional discussions happen and occur about site redesign and redevelopment, making sure this is part of the narrative. So we wanted to highlight some additional resources at the end of this presentation. We see several here for brownfields and land revitalization, some of which Anne mentioned earlier, but this is a bit of an expanded list. We have one on Superfund climate resilience and some other EPA resources, including the Create Climate Resilience for Water Utilities tool, which allows you to explore some of these other climate change hazards like changes in precipitation as well, and the ARCX Climate Change Adaptation Resource Exchange. So at that point, I can take Q&A on this case study or on the earlier presentation as well, and if we still have some questions from that. And I believe that Jean's going to pull up some questions for you to answer as well while I take your questions.
Yes, we're keeping it the information flowing here. So there was one question that I started to answer, and I think Kevin also weighed in on, which was, what was the choice of the city of Philadelphia in terms of which of the curves and worst-case scenarios mm-hmm. or best-case scenarios did they choose for the?
Right. So we defaulted to the default recommendation that I made for all of you, which was that middle-of-the-road intermediate scenario for transportation infrastructure. That's what we're seeing starting to be recommended by federal agencies like Federal Highway Administration, as well as the research organizations like the Transportation Research Board. So that intermediate scenario is what we used. The time frame selected was that 2050 timeframe to align with the useful life of the roadway. So it's anticipated that the bridge or the roadway will be built in the next few years here and would have a useful life out to 2050. So we want to protect the investment until then. There's also a bridge segment included in the roadway, and that's why we looked out at the 2100 projections as well, because the bridge we would anticipate would be there until approximately 2100 before it needs to be reconstructed. So we focused, I didn't talk about the bridge as much today. There were other recommendations for that, but we focused in on the 2100 scenario for the bridge.
So there is, well, first I want to remind everybody who might not have answered the questions, would you like more training of this nature? And so far we have 100%. That's good news. What other topics would you want to learn about? Please weigh in. This is your chance. What was the level of detail? Was this the right level? Did you want more basic or more advanced information? So please weigh in on those two. And then there's another question here about using capping at brownfield sites as part of their remedy, and have folks looked at ways of venting rising groundwater to avoid damage to subsurface geomembrane caps?
That's a good question, and it's expanding beyond my area of expertise. So Kevin or Ann, I wonder if one of the two of you want to take a stab at that.
So I was hoping Kevin might weigh in on that one.
Hi, Ann. This is Kevin. I'll try to weigh in, but unfortunately, I have not heard of venting groundwater. I mean, it's kind of an interesting idea, but you know, unfortunately, the idea of capping is that you're usually leaving residual contamination in place. So venting rising groundwater could potentially be resurfacing contaminated groundwater. So it's an interesting idea. We certainly would want to make sure you're capturing that vented, quote, groundwater to ensure that what is being vented is captured and cleaned up appropriately and disposed of. But a very interesting question.
Thank you, Kevin. There was another question about, you know, how was the EPA responding and forecasting, you know, the number of sites that might be in flood areas or subject to sea level rise. And I think the question is that, you know, many of our different colleagues and contaminated land programs are working on that. And I don't know if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share on that, Brenda.
I think that was a good response, Anne. Thank you.
So for those of you who might not have weighed in, since people are no longer shy on the chat, you need not be either. We have a few more minutes for questions if you'd like to weigh in. And, of course, for those of you who are planning on coming to Oklahoma City for the next National Brownfields Training Conference, if there's topics related to this that you think should be on the agenda, that would be useful to raise to your colleagues. I think they're getting shy now, or their blood sugars have dropped.
That's right. I think we got some good questions.
And one helpful little trick, sometimes I'll ask the audience if they have no questions to go ahead and put in that you have no additional questions. So if you have them, get them in. If you have none, type no questions and send that in, and that way we'll have feedback no matter what stance you have.
There you go, and that's the master at work. Aren't we glad we have Jean to organize this for us? We do have a question about what are the most common reuses of brownfields subject to sea level rise? And I think that is a good question. I don't know that I know the answer to that. Maybe you have a general answer to that for us, Brenda.
Right. I do have a general answer, and so I think it gets back to this question of, is it going to be permanently inundated, as we saw at that first screen, or is it only going to be inundated during storm surge events. And the storm surge events is something that we're more equipped to manage through sea walls and things of that nature. You can usually proceed with whichever type of reuse strategies you would like. But for those permanently inundated locations, you know, those are sites where we anticipate that even if you've protected the site, your roadway connections to it aren't going to be great. The other infrastructure that's running out there might not be able to operate in that type of environment. And so that's where we would want to encourage you to consider maybe temporary uses. So we frequently see things like a parking lot, if that's an amenity that your community is looking for. Since you can move those cars, it's not a large investment that you can move the cars in the near term when they are experiencing more frequent flooding. Once you get to permanent flooding, it's not as hard to give up that type of location. We've also seen in the short-term solutions like greenhouses or things of that nature, or storage, as a way to take advantage of the space now, but understand that you're likely going to have to give it up as those permanent sea level rise levels approach and you have more and more frequent flooding. Then the alternative, you can turn it more into the public amenity. There's some really interesting work. I'd recommend taking a look at China Basin Park in San Francisco that's currently being planned so that it's terraced up. And so you basically lose portions of the park over time, but still provide that amenity. And as each of the terraces starts to flood more and more frequently, it transitions from sort of public space to habitat space. So that's an interesting concept as well.
I will definitely look that up. We have one more question, I think, and then I think we're getting the word to wrap it up. So this last question is, how do you balance elevating waterfront to provide resiliency versus wetland and floodplain existing regulations that prohibit such strategies? And I think the example that you just cited touches a little bit to that, but you might have some other thoughts on the balance between kind of waterfront redevelopment and also the need for, you know, areas that can act like a sponge.
Yeah. So I think that the issue that most people are running into with this is that question of addressing the current regulatory environment that hasn't necessarily evolved to consider sea level rise. And so permitting can be difficult. A lot of these other items can be difficult. But what I would say is that your permitting agencies and your regulatory agencies, even if they haven't changed the guidance yet, they are starting to think about this, certainly. Some of them are very advanced in it. So partnering with them early to have conversations about what can we do in this situation, you know, we understand the risk, we want to work with you to come up with a solution that is efficient and effective and reasonable. I think you'll be surprised, hopefully, at how open they are to that.
So I think we are done, and I think we want to turn it back over to Jean. Is that correct, Jean?
Thank you. That is correct. I'm going to walk through a few quick final housekeeping items to make sure that everybody understands how to close out today's live broadcast. So with that, I'm going to change the screen here and bring up our closing reminders. So one of the very first things I want to do is thank everybody who participated in our session today. We had nearly 180 live participants on for today's session from all over, actually, the U.S. and a few international attendees, so thank you for joining us. I also want to thank our organizers and presenters for sharing their expertise today. For those of you who would like to stay connected and learn more about free online internet seminar opportunities like today, I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org. You can also sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month. So I encourage you to visit us there, add your name to our mailing list, and then you can get an automatic email every month to let you know when there's new webinars like this. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, as well as a variety of other resources. We have already posted those items up on the resources or seminar page. So I'll encourage you to click the links. You'll see it on the middle right under related URLs to the seminar resources page. You can click that link to select it and then hit the Browse To button, and that'll open it up. You'll also find contact information for our presenters and organizers there, and there's also a link to our feedback form. Now, for those of you who are participating in today's session and you're looking for PDHs or CEUs, we don't issue those types of credit hours. However, we can provide you with a certificate for joining us in today's live broadcast, as well as those of you who are watching the recorded version of today's session. The way to get a participation certificate is to fill out that online feedback form. It doesn't matter if you are here live or you're watching the recorded version. Simply follow the links to the seminar feedback form. Again, you'll find that on the middle right under related URLs in the seminar feedback link. Just click it to select it, and it should open up in the website. The other thing that I'll just say is, as you're filling that form out, please be sure that, number one, you include your email address correctly, and that you check the box at the bottom of the feedback form to then certify you were here for the entire session, whether you replayed the whole thing or you were here live. As soon as you've done that and you submit the feedback form, you'll then immediately have access to a certificate. You can print it out. We'll also email a copy to you. And I encourage you to keep those for your own training records. If you happen to have multiple people join you at your location, each person can fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register individually. So if you hosted a viewing party at your spot, just simply give the attendees who joined you a link to that feedback form. They can fill it out on their own and get their own certificate. Again, if you're watching the archive version, you can still fill out that form. Just click the link. They're active in our archives, and you can share your thoughts and get a certificate. And I'll just remind everybody that today's session was recorded, and you'll automatically receive an email as soon as the archive is available for on-demand playback. And so with that, I look forward to getting your feedback and, again, having you join us on a future webinar. With that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.